from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, what is a journalist's role when covering social issues like homelessness and poverty? Should journalists stick with the facts or should they propose possible solutions? That's the question that Daniel Hempel explores in Journalism for Social Change, an online course he teaches at UC Berkeley. We'll talk with Hempel and David Bornstein of the Solutions Journalism Network about the line between journalism and advocacy. Then at 10:30, famed British playwright and screenwriter Tom Stoppard will join us. Best known for plays like Arcadia, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead, and the film Shakespeare in Love, he brings his play Indian Ink back to San Francisco this month. The play explores an academic search to piece together a romance from 1930s India. That's next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to another hour of this morning's Forum program. And in this opening segment of our second hour, we investigate solutions journalism, the idea that reporting on social and political problems needs to find out what solutions have been put forth or being worked on or are indeed working. Joining us for this half-hour segment are two of the leading advocates and change agents for solutions journalism, both award-winning journalists. Daniel Hempel and David Bornstein. Daniel Hempel is here with us in studio. He directs Fostering Media Connection. He also teaches a journalism course for social change, which is a massive open online course. It's at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy. Daniel Hempel, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you. Also glad to have David Bornstein, who is with us by phone, co-founder of the Solutions Journalism Network. David Bornstein, welcome.
Thanks, Michael.
Glad to have you both. And Daniel Hempel, let me begin with you. And let me begin also just by saying to listeners that this is now something that used to be called, I think, civic journalism, but now we have this emphasis on solutions. And maybe we ought to go into sort of semantic differences here. What is the difference? We used to talk about journalism in the public interest. We're still doing it. When you talk about solutions, you mean advocacy or you don't mean advocacy?
I don't mean advocacy. I mean looking, trying to say, well, most of our coverage is about pathologies, about things that are going wrong in our culture. And instead of reporting on the end of the world, actually reporting on solutions out of it. And so it would be matching all that coverage of problems with solutions. And then the thing that I really like to do and teach is also talking about institutional barriers to seeing those solutions actually happen so that you could essentially light a way towards potential solutions. Now, by virtue of your reporting, you may find 10 different potential solutions to a given problem, and you have to give them weight based on the context and the information you have.
And that's not based on or doesn't, in fact, imply advocacy?
Well, I think it could be a dangerous road to go down if you start using the moniker of journalism and then and putting forward certain solutions that are not fully vetted and haven't been weighed against other potential solutions. So I don't see that there's anything about advocacy in just spending as much time reporting on solutions as you do as reporting on problems.
Well, let's use some examples here, because I know back in 2006 you got started on doing work on foster care and actually did award-winning work on that. You met a young man and it all started from that point forward. A young man named Chris read a good deal about this and was impressed with the work you did. But in reporting it, where does it move from just reporting it in terms of like what he's going through, what obstacles he faces, what barriers institutional, and then saying these are possible solutions?
Well, I mean, I think it just sensitized me to the idea that we need to be focusing on solutions for these kids in a much more dramatic way. So for me, working in this field and trying to recruit an army of journalists to cover these issues from a solution-based perspective is a means to an end. I will not disavow the fact that my intent is to improve the lives of kids in need. Does that compromise my journalism? I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think that trying to find answers to some of these endemic problems is a problematic enterprise.
And David Bornstein, we're talking about, you call it fixes. It's journalism for social change. So journalism for social change means that you are trying perhaps to at least inspire or be a catalyst for social change. Doesn't that also seem like advocacy?
The fixes column that we write in the New York Times is an example of solutions journalism. No, I agree with Daniel. I mean, we are very allergic to advocacy. It's really just reporting on, if you're reporting on a problem, the causes of the problem, the people who are making that problem worse, the people who are ignoring that problem, you can also report on the people who are responding to that problem, and you can do it with equal rigor. So around any issue, take high school dropouts. There are going to be people ignoring the problem, making matters worse, people trying things that aren't working, and then there will be people who are responding to the problem with evidence of some success in getting results. Typically, journalists focus on the worst performers, and they try to shame them and watchdog them, which is very important. But you could also report on the people who are responding and showing results of success, obviously with some evidence. You need something to stand on to say that this is a response that's working. And the interesting thing about solutions journalism, it's not feel good, it's not positive news or fluff or advocacy. It's really just reporting on human activity with an effort to try to understand what's happening here that's different from the results that other people are getting. So it's really journalism for knowledge, to produce more knowledge for society about how to do better against the problem.
I like the way you put it, problems scream and solutions whisper. So the idea is to go beyond sort of who, what, where, and why and get into how?
The how is a key question, and in fact, we call these stories often, they often play like whodunits or detective stories, because you're really following people, organizations, groups on a journey to try to do better against the problem, and usually they try things that doesn't work, it works halfway, it might work, but it's too expensive or it's politically unfeasible. So people over the course of a 5 or a 10 year journey will often be trying to develop better solutions to problems, solutions or approaches that can scale more rapidly. There's always trade-offs, there's always limitations. Sometimes you think something's working and you think it's terrific, and then a big study comes in and you find out you're not getting the results. That's also an example where you can come in with a report saying, why didn't it work as well as we thought? And you can bring more knowledge to the issue. But constantly covering the problems without covering the responses gives society, it doesn't give them a sense of efficacy or a sense that there are possibilities, and that actually causes people to tune out. And in fact, it creates a negative. Journalism actually could create people, could decrease people's sense of possibilities, even when there are credible possibilities out there.
You mentioned the New York Times, and I know that some of the students that David's been, that Daniel's been working with have published and chronicle of social change journals like that. But there's also partnerships with this new kind of journalism. For example, Seattle Times, I think you have a partnership with, and Fayetteville newspaper.
Yeah, we've actually worked with 40 different news organizations around the U.S., Michael. Seattle Times is our biggest partnership with a project that they call Education Lab. It's now in the second year. They have decided to orient their education coverage to look at, when they look at problems, to also look at the responses to those problems. And so they've been doing deep dive, solutions-oriented coverage. Very rigorous, hard-nosed stuff. And they've identified lots of examples of things in Seattle where people are getting better results, and they're explaining them. And in some cases, they've gone to other cities to look at models in other cities that Seattle could benefit from knowing about. And in each case, they sort of, it's not just reporting on the fact that another city or another organization is getting a result, but trying to understand, to demystify what's actually going on here that's different. And they've surveyed their readership, and they found that the readers really appreciate, close to 90% said in a survey that they appreciate the focus on a solution that seemed to be working. And in this case, 84% of educators in a survey said that they were that they had actually spoken to somebody else about an article that they read in the Seattle Times and felt it interesting to them.
Well, I'm going to ask you, our listeners, what you think about this idea of solutions journalism, or fixes, as David Bornstein's column puts forward, and the idea that you can actually do really fair and unbiased reporting and offer these kinds of solutions. And what kinds of problems particularly come to your mind when you think about what Daniel Hempel calls the fiscal and moral responsibility of finding solutions? We welcome your calls and your involvement in the program. In fact, you can join us now at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. And if you have questions or comments, now would be the time to call. This is a half-hour segment, and we would like to hear from you. So feel free to join us now at 866 866-733-6786 or email us, forum@kqed.org, or post your questions or comments right onto our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. You can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We actually asked on Facebook, should journalists offer solutions to serious social or political problems, or do you prefer when journalists simply report the facts? Let me just read a couple of responses. Felix says, are you kidding? How can it be called journalism when you take sides on an issue, when the objective becomes subjective? When you insert your morality into a debate, have you not crossed the line into propaganda and advocacy? Noel says, to keep its journalistic integrity, it would have to report possible solutions from opposing viewpoints and weigh them objectively against one another. It doesn't always need to be political news, and it could be mundane, but all possible reasonable solutions should be presented and evaluated. There you have kind of two sides comment, Daniel Hempel.
Well, I think that that's a great example of the kind of fear that this kind of stuff elicits, which you said was civic journalism, which never seemed to have the same kind of problems. But I think that we're in a world where people are so concerned and where you have so much misinformation out there that somebody coming in and saying we're going to focus on solutions could easily be a vehicle for somebody's propaganda. So for somebody like me or somebody like David who's out there trying to focus on solutions in a way that hopefully inspires some kind of change, inspires some kind of engagement, inspires some kind of response from the reader. You have to be aware that you're going to be looked at with heightened scrutiny. And with heightened scrutiny comes the opportunity to either work harder and have a tighter explanation of everything that's going on or not. And the consequence of not having that is the loss of credibility. At which point, what's the point of doing anything anyway? So, yes, you need to be objective. And the second your objectivity, the second your thirst for knowledge gets compromised, you're gone.
Journalists have said many times on this air, you can't really be objective and be a journalist. You're just using language, just using your own observations, filtering them through and whatever makes it almost virtually impossible. But I wonder, David Bornstein, what your response would be to this email from a listener named Jean who says, when journalists write about programs as solutions, do they also review empirical evidence about whether the programs are effective? And are journalists trained to evaluate statistical studies that assess efficacy? Mm-hmm.
That's a great question. We, in our model of solutions journalism, and we have all sorts of toolkits on our website, we really say that it's very important to start with what's knowable as much as possible, the research or the data or evidence. And if you as a journalist are not the person who knows how to look at a study and understand whether it's a well-conducted study, you should have sources who can help you work that through. But I think it's very important. I don't think journalists should be in the business of offering solutions or picking winners. They don't know enough. And often what seems to be working, if you find out 6 months later, if you look again, you realize it's not working as well as you thought it was. But the point is, you know, it gets back to this question of objectivity. Journalists should focus on important activity in the world, activity that is significant vis-a-vis major social concerns. So obviously, if people are doing something bad, if they're bullying, if there's bullying in a school, or if there are kids who are being neglected in some way, we would say immediately we should respond to that. We should focus on that as a story. But if there are a place where there are interesting responses that are reducing a problem, we should also focus on that and try to understand what's going on there. But once again, it's not offering solutions. It's just reporting on things that are going on in the world. In some ways, I would say that most journalists, by avoiding the responses, give a very biased and incomplete view of the world. It's not really an accurate and truthful view of the world if you avoid a lot of human activity just because it happens to be responsive activity.
David Bornstein is with us from New York City. He's a co-founder of Solutions Journalism Network, and Daniel Hempel is here in studio. He directs the Fostering Media Connections and teaches a Journalism for Social Change massive open online course, a MOOC, at UC Berkeley's Goldman School of Public Policy. I want to go to your calls here for a moment, but Daniel, I read some of your students reporting and working some rather impressive pieces, I must say, about really sort of tugs at the heart because the details are pretty vivid about, for example, a kid who goes on a joyride taking a car for a joyride and winds up incarcerated, and a young woman who at seven is turned out as a prostitute and lives under sexual abuse and is part of the sex trafficking. Are you instructing these young people to tell the story? The stories themselves can be quite gripping. And also to move towards some kind of ways to say, this is what needs to be done, this is what has to be done, this is what's being done or can be done?
Well, I think that it's interesting. This is a debate I had with Dean Brady at the Goldman School and Jennifer Granholm.
Henry Brady, yeah.
Yeah, and we were discussing this idea of the anecdotes, and Dean Brady and Jennifer Granholm were telling me, Daniel, it's all about the anecdote to pull you in. And, of course, the first thing you do is point to the anecdote. So the anecdote is a very important piece, but if we're taking a child, in this case life, and not offering some kind of explanation of ways to alleviate that situation for that person particularly or other people in the same situation, there's really no point in doing it. So yes, I the students of the class at Berkeley, the students of the class online, we've got 200 of them in our small private online class, 2,600 have signed up for the MOOC. You guys can all sign up on air. But they are instructed to look at this issue of children, vulnerable children and youth, because I think it is probably the most fundamentally important issue.
Sometimes the solutions are you have a young girl who's essentially being exploited and used for sex trafficking, and then somehow she manages to, by sheer will and determination, to get away from it. I mean, that in itself can be an inspiring solution. It doesn't necessarily have to come from, in some instances, changing the system. It comes from will and determination.
Well, I mean, and that's something you can also test for. So there's a lot of data and studies about the risk factors for subsequent horrible, deleterious effects on your life. But what are the protective factors that you have? So what are the protective factors in that woman's life that helped her get forward?
Well, it wasn't being put in jail. She makes it very clear that
right.
Being put in jail is just like being out on the streets under, from her perspective, oppressed in a different way. Let me go to our callers, though, and let's begin, Mike, with you. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. A little bit of background is I feel like a lot of the best science writing, popular science writing that's coming out is actually not from scientists, which is unfortunate, but it's from journalists who, you know, will tell the whole story, the backstory around it. And I was just wondering, a lot of times they will take positions on scientific issues. For example, climate change is a big one. And I was just wondering what the panel thought, you know, whether that would be considered advocacy or whether that's responsible journalism.
That's a good question, David Bornstein.
I mean, I think that, you know, from the point of view of the journalist, you should be reporting on what the preponderance of the research indicates. I think that that's a clear journalistic responsibility. I mean, obviously, we never know anything with certainty, but there is a preponderance with that particular issue. I also think journalists can go a little bit further. A lot of the denial of climate change comes from people who presuppose that the solutions, they actually deny climate change because they don't like the solutions they will have to put into effect if they agree it's a problem. And in fact, there's a wide range of responses to climate change. They're not all big government responses. Some of them are actually very much private sector, Walmart, thrifty, you know, reducing your cost, your supply chain and your global footprint responses. So I think if journalists did a better job actually reporting on all of the different models out there that are emerging around the world to reduce the carbon footprint and how companies are actually managing to do this and in some cases increasing their profits, it would actually create a condition where more people are willing to accept the science that's out there and the preponderance of the evidence.
And let me get another caller on here. That's Peter, who's joining us from San Francisco. Peter, welcome.
Yes, hi. I wanted to say that I'm glad you're having the program, of course, but I'm not clear how solution journalism differs from basically what's been done all along and should be done, which is report various sides of an issue, including the folks that have ideas about what the solutions or how improvements can happen. What I think is very important, though, is that often there isn't sufficient problem, if you like, journalism, which is to say good journalism that doesn't ignore or misreport or poorly report what's actually going on and thereby preventing people from understanding what's happening.
Yeah, David Hempel.
I think that there's an opportunity. If I look at and I read the newspapers, maybe there is more solutions journalism getting reintegrated in. But I think that for quite a long time, we have not been focusing on potential answers to some of these endemic problems. I know that in the field that I'm most interested in child maltreatment and child maltreatment prevention, the kind of solutions that are bandied about are just not even close to the scope and scale of what you'd actually need. And I think that there's a big problem, especially in the child welfare context, wherein you have journalists that drop in and cover issues of child death and really horrible situations. And that becomes the prevailing narrative of what the system is. So you think less than 1% of all children will die under the watch of the child welfare system, but now that has become the dominant narrative of this of quote unquote broken system. So I think that that's a good place for examples where the solutions are not forthcoming in the mainstream media, and that's a horrible disservice to hundreds of thousands of kids across the country.
You teach your students, though, to pretty much focus on single issues?
Yeah.
Email, David Bornstein, from a listener named Wendy, who says, what I'd like to see more of is the context and history of a problem and what solutions were tried in the past and in other places and countries. A clearinghouse of information about what works is very important to not reinvent the wheel.
Oh, absolutely. I think, if you're doing good reporting on an issue, you're providing the context. In some cases, the question is what's missing from the conversation. If there is not outrage and awareness about a problem, then you need to sort of do a traditional watchdog story and get people to realize it's a problem and to call it out. If people don't understand the history of that problem, you need to bring that in. Oftentimes that's the case. And in many cases, I would say in the majority of cases, the thing that's most missing from the debate is an awareness of what are the credible responses out there in the world? What's possible? I mean, I speak at universities often, and I'll give the students 90 seconds. I say, think of all the problems you can think of in the world. You have 90 seconds. Now think of the potential responses or solutions that are working. And we put them up on the blackboard. And there's, 100 things on the problem side and 5 things on the solution side. People are far, far less informed about credible responses out there in the world. And it reduces their efficacy. It reduces their ability to imagine a better society, to know where as citizens they could put their talents and their resources. It really reduces their imagination for what their lives could be in some sense.
Yeah, I like the analogy I read of yours where you say you keep telling kids not to do this, not to do that, and so forth, as opposed to framing it in a more positive way about what can be done and what ought to be done in a positive sense of change. Can you talk just for a moment, we're almost at the end of the segment, but about something that I know is important to you, and that's social norming?
Yeah, so there's a fair amount of research out now that, in fact, what people think of the normal behavior tends to become legitimized. So one of the more common applications is on college campuses, there's a tendency for binge drinking to be a big problem in many colleges. Some of the colleges that have reduced this problem have simply told their students that their peers actually drink less than they think they do. And when they tell people that the normal alcohol consumption is actually lower, people reduce their own drinking to conform to the norm. This has been shown to increase voting or to decrease smoking. It has a lot of applications. But journalists always run the danger of norming negative behavior, making it seem that every police officer is racist or everybody in a company is unethical. And that actually legitimizes bad behavior. It's potentially a big danger.
Let me just read one more email here. I prefer the facts. A listener writes, propaganda makes its way into my news more and more, and it's exhausting. Talking points repeated over and over and allowing everyone to have an opinion without having to back it up with the facts leaves us listeners left in limbo, repeating things that are not true. On that note, we conclude. Thank you, Daniel Hempel. Thank you, David Bornstein.